Yeah, so last lecture we set up the structure of general relativity and differential geometry, and so the time is ripe to explain why the structure of Yang-Mills is similar. It's a good way to see Yang-Mills presented, and so I just want to take a little bit of time at the beginning of the lecture to explain that a little bit, and then it'll be easier to go through the notes on your own. So in general relativity, if we had a vector under a coordinate transformation, the coordinates transformed as the components of that vector transformed to some new components, we said according to this law, and so now similarly in Yang-Mills theory. Let's say we might have some column vector of n scalar fields. So let's say, these are not Lorentz indices. These aren't indices that transform under coordinate transformations. They're indices that transform under gauge transformations. And so under a gauge transformation, this is just like the components of this got mixed up by this matrix. The idea is we want the idea of Yang-Mills theory is that the scalar and spinner fields are going to be arranged into column vectors of scalar fields or column vectors of spinner fields that get mixed up by an internal symmetry transformation. So there's some matrix like. Okay, and then the new components are related to the old components by some transformation matrix. Let's just, for specificity, let's assume that this is a unitary matrix, and we'll be talking about UN or SUN gauge theory. So UN, I hope you'll speak up if anything. I'm not trying to say anything incomprehensible to you, so. I'm speaking in a kind of way that is where I know you've seen this a little bit before earlier in the course. So, but if something I say doesn't make sense, I hope someone will stop me. But so in UN or SUN gauge theory, that just means that's a gauge theory in which the transformation matrices are elements of the unitary group. So in other words, they all satisfy this property that U dagger. Is equal to U. They're all matrices, n by n matrices that satisfy the capital N by n matrices that satisfy U dagger is equal to U inverse, or elements of SUN, in which case they satisfy the additional property that determinant of U is equal to 1. Okay. And so, in general relativity, the idea is you can make an arbitrary coordinate transformation. So this matrix will depend; it'll change from position to position on the manifold. And in gauge theory, the idea is exactly the same, that this matrix you're also going to let depend on the position of the manifold, the position where you are on the space-time manifold. So phi twiddle, the components of phi at x will transform in this way, but the matrix that transforms them can depend on what position x you're at. So anyway, so you see that this is that phi is playing a role exactly analogous to the vector, and this transformation matrix here is playing a role exactly analogous to this factor that we include in general relativity whenever we want to transform one of the indices on a tensor, right? And then, what is the end game? The end game in special relativity or in general relativity, sort of the key idea. Was that the basic symmetry of the theory is symmetry under coordinate transformations. So you want to, at the end of the day, write down a Lagrangian and an action, which is invariant under coordinate transformations. That's the way you encapsulate that symmetry when you define the theory. And to do that, to write down a Lagrangian that is a scalar, but under coordinate transformations, when I say it's invariant under coordinate transformations, that's just a particular type of tensor. That means it is the thing we call a scalar. And the way to build such a thing is you build it out of tensors. That's why we went to so much trouble. Ultimately, that's one way to say why we went to so much trouble to define things that were tensors, because once we have a bunch of tensors, we can make scalars easily by we just take, you know, if we have one scalar field, or one tensor field, you know, who knows what that is, and then two other vector fields, you know, as long as I make sure that all of the indices that appear on these various tensors are contracted with one another, what I've written down is a Lorentz scalar, and so it's a sort of a valid term that can appear in my action. Okay, so once I have things that transform as tensors under coordinate transformation, I can write, that's the stage at which I can easily now write down objects, scalar terms that can be valid sort of terms in an action that is general relativistic. So Yang-Mills theory, the idea is exactly the same, but with these internal symmetry transformations. And so what we want is we want things that transform as vectors and tensors, but not with respect to coordinate transformations. We want to find things that transform as vectors and tensors with this thing playing the role of with these. So let me use Greek indices for sort of the indices that transform under coordinate transformations, coordinate indices, and Latin indices for indices that run from 1 to n, where n is the size of the gauge group. So these are So what we want is we want to build tensors under the gauge group, vectors, tensors. We want things to transform nicely, just like we did in general relativity, so that at the end of the day we can build an action, the Yang-Mills action, by linking everything up so that all of the gauge indices, all the upper gauge indices get contracted with a lower gauge index, so that the thing that you write down, the Lagrangian that you write down, is a scalar under gauge transformations. Okay? And so just like we were led immediately to introduce a covariant derivative here by the observation that this object, as soon as we, you know, we're going to want to take derivatives, but we're going to want derivatives of fields to appear in our action, but we spent a long time in the first lecture seeing that if you take the partial derivative of a vector, then if this thing transforms like a vector, under coordinate transformations, this thing does not transform like a vector under coordinate transformations. And so we had to modify this. We had to replace the partial derivative by a covariant derivative, which had, I have this new principle that I'm going to try to put the eraser down so that it's at a safe distance from me. Which acts like this. Well, so that isn't even my Russian joke yet. Okay, so similarly, we immediately run into a problem, which is that if we act on this thing with a ordinary partial derivative, so, and let's when we're talking about Yang-Mills theory, to not confuse things overly, let's forget about curved spacetime and all of that. So we're going to do Yang-Mills theory on flat spacetime. So we're talking about special relativity. Forget about the metric, the curvature, the Christoffel symbols are all zero. Well, let's just do one thing at a time. The point is that now, just like we wanted this thing to be, a tensor with one upper coordinate index and one lower coordinate index, we look at this thing, we want this thing to be a tensor with one lower coordinate index that transforms like a coordinate index should under Lorentz transformations, and one upper gauge index that transforms like a gauge index should under coordinate transformations. In other words, like this transformation law. But it doesn't do that. So if we make a gauge transformation here, that's d mu of u a b, which depends on x, phi b. But now when we expand out this derivative acting on a product, we get one term that looks okay, one term that looks the way we want it to look. Okay, that's how a gauge index should transform. But then we get this other term, which comes from the fact that we were letting u depend on x. Okay, and so again, just as we did up here, the trick is to modify the partial derivative to an appropriate covariant derivative to remove that extra bit. So instead, we're going to define the gauge covariant derivative capital D sub beta acting on phi twiddle A to be, again, the ordinary partial derivative but then again we're going to add a little extra bit. And now, so here, remember the meaning of the covariant of the Christoffel symbol, the idea of it was that for every beta, for every direction in which we want to take the covariant derivative, we have these other two indices which are like a little matrix that performs some extra linear transformation on V. And so the same thing is what we want here. For every direction beta, what we're going to want is a matrix, but here the indices should be the gauge indices. We want to rotate this vector in the gauge sense. It's this thing with one gauge index. So it'll have two extra indices A and C, contracted with C. If it's not obvious, this in other words, the thing I'm trying to stress here is that this guy is playing virtually exactly the same role as this guy is. In gauge theory. So this is the connection on the tangent bundle. So in other words, it's this. Remember this. The idea here was that if you have a little vector with a coordinate index v mu, and another little vector somewhere else in space-time, u mu living over at this point. So this point will be p, and this point will be q, and you have a little curve connecting them. If you want to parallel transport this guy along the curve to see if it's parallel to this thing, the thing that you need is this connection on the space in which these things live, and these things live in different these things live in what is called the tangent bundle. But anyway, so the point is the things in the tangent bundle are at every point in space. There's a little vector which is like a tangent vector that has one or more, or a tensor that has one or more coordinate indices. Whereas now we have these other sorts of vectors that can live over space-time, but they have different indices. So now you have a little vector over here at point P. There's a little vector of scalar fields, where vector is in the sense of just that it has, not that it's a vector pointing in some direction in space, but that it's a n component vector of column vector of scalar fields, and another vector phi prime of A over here. And now if you have a path connecting those two points in space-time and you want to know if those two guys are parallel, the object that you need to do the exactly analogous parallel transport is the connection on the gauge bundle, aka what you would usually call the gauge field. Okay? That clear? And so now you remember that when we had introduced the connection, we immediately did two things. The first thing we said is, first thing we figured out was, how does this thing need to transform in order that this thing has the right properties of transforming like a tensor with respect to each of its indices? And then the second, so that, you know, we did that for this, and now we're about to do that for this. And then the second thing that we did was we defined the curvature of this connection So in this case, remember the transformation law. These are coordinate transformations. These are gauge transformations. So here we figured out by demanding that this thing was a tensor, we figured out how this transforms under coordinate transformations. We're going to do the same thing here, and that's going to tell us how the gauge field transforms under gauge transformations. Okay, so this gauge transformation law that I actually don't know how it was presented the first time, but often it sort of comes out of nowhere, like here's what you have to do to get your action to be invariant or something like that. It has this very geometrical meaning that's exactly analogous to what we derive for gamma. And then here we defined the curvature of this connection by looking at the commutator of two covariant derivatives acting on a vector. So delta alpha, or grad alpha, grad beta, minus grad beta, grad alpha, acting on a vector we said was the curvature tensor contracted with the vector. And we're going to do the same thing here. We look at the commutator of two covariant derivatives. And use that to define the curvature tensor. But in this case, the thing that is that will pop out that is the curvature tensor is nothing but what you usually call the field strength, F mu nu, associated with this gauge field, A mu nu. So it's the thing that that in ordinary electromagnetism is this. And then there are some correction terms in Yang-Mills theory that might seem mysterious or hard to derive at first. And the point is this is a nice, very geometrical way to remember what those are and quickly re-derive them for yourself, okay, and just conceptually understand why they're there. Okay, so let me just do that quickly, and then I think that's more or less all I want to say about this. So if we want this thing, so let's just focus on gauge transformations. Let's forget about gravity. If we want this thing to this has one lower index that's a coordinate index, and since we're not going to be talking about coordinate transformations here, forget about that. So what we want is that when we act with the gauge covariant derivative on this thing, that after it gets acted on, it still has one upper gauge. It still acts like an object with one upper gauge index. We want to know. So in other words, we want under a coordinate transformation that under a gauge transformation that when phi goes to phi twiddle, which is let me just suppress the indices and just use ordinary sort of matrix notation. So this is an n dimensional column vector, and I want it to transform like that. And so if I want this thing to also transform like an n-component column vector, so in other words, I want this to be equal, the transformed thing to just be equal to the way a column vector transforms, u times the untransformed thing. I know how this guy transforms. I know how phi transforms. So I have d twiddle of beta acting on u phi. But then it's clear that if I want this to be equal to this, that the transformation law that I should choose for d twiddle is d twiddle of beta is equal to u d sub beta times u inverse. Because if I plug this expression in here, this u inverse hits this u and cancels, and I'm just left with the remaining u. Okay, and so if I plug this expression in here, I get this, which is what I wanted. Okay, so this is how I want the covariant derivative to the gauge covariant derivative to transform. And so now the question is, so this is exactly the same calculation we were doing, we did on the first lecture for the covariant derivative, but in slightly slicker notation. Okay, I want this to be true, but I can write this guy as d sub beta plus ig a sub beta twiddle, and I can write this guy as u d sub beta, partial sub beta, plus ig a sub beta u inverse. So now, remember, both sides of this equation are operators. They operate on something like a column vector of scalar fields or a column vector of spinner fields. So if you look at the first term here, u partial sub beta times u inverse, that really means first I multiply the column vector times u inverse, and then I act on that product with del sub beta. But you know that's going to split. But that derivative is going to split that product into two terms, and so those two terms will be that when the partial passes through the u and acts on whatever column vector this operator is acting on, that will give a term like this. And on the other hand, the second term will be where the partial acts on this and does not act on the column vector. So that will give a term like this, and then there's our final term that we involving a. Okay, and so now u inverse, you know, that's just the identity matrix. So this partial and this partial cancel each other. And so we're left with ig times a twiddle is equal to this stuff over here. So that's the transformation law, that under a gauge transformation, that's how you know that a gauge field should transform, like okay. So that was the first thing, and then. So is that clear to everybody? Yeah.
Actually, I have a question. So why is it dy beta on the left hand side, not dy beta
on the left shoulder? Oh, that's a good question. So remember this thing is really a matrix. So for every value of beta, it is a matrix that acts on the gauge vector space, on the n-component, n-dimensional vector space of scalar fields that we're talking about, let's say. So I haven't been writing out the indices here. But in other words, I've been writing the beta index, but I've been suppressing the two. There's two gauge indices everywhere. So really, there is a delta, the unit matrix, delta AC here, and then as we said before, the gauge field itself has its own indices, AC, like this. And so it's not the delta that's being transformed by a gauge transformation. It's the gauge part that's being transformed by a gauge transformation. But under unitary transformation, the unit matrix acting on a vector space is invariant. Gauge so under if the unit matrix is this stop me when this is clear. If you have the unit matrix on some vector space, and then you take a new basis on that same vector space. So you take some new basis, which differs from the old basis by unitary transformation. Then the unit matrix in that new basis is just the same matrix. It's the unit matrix. It has this exact same form. The form of it is invariant of that transformation. Let's see. Okay, so
could you explain why the first and the last term on the last line on the left hand side came, left hand four?
the one
that you canceled?
Where these two terms came from?
Yeah.
Do you mean why this term split into two terms?
Yeah.
So it's an operator equation. These are both operators. So let's to be clear about things and not so slick. Let's actually have the operators operate on something, anything. Let's have them operate on any arbitrary vector, column vector of a scalar fields. So this guy, if that's an operator, it's operating on something, some n component column vector of scalar fields. But what this operator means, this ordering has a meaning. The left to right ordering has a meaning. These things don't commute with one another. It means first you take this column vector and you act on it with this n by n matrix, which depends on space. So it depends on x because it's a gauge because that's the idea of a gauge transformation, and then this guy also depends on x. But then after you've acted with that matrix, then you take the derivative. But that means that when you take the derivative of this guy, you have one term that looks like the derivative acting on the u.
Oh, it's just a product.
Exactly.
Okay. And then, what about the last term? Why is the minus u to the power of minus 1?
Oh, that's just a typo. Sorry, that's an error. Thank you. Did I mess that up also over? That's correct over here.
Okay.
So, what's the best thing to erase? I'm going to erase this stuff, maybe? Okay. So the next thing is that remember the way we defined the curvature. We said ordinary partial derivatives always commute. But covariant derivatives need not commute, and if there's curvature on the space, they won't commute. In fact, that is going to be how we define the Riemann curvature on the space, or the Cooper correction. So, this is up to the omission of the word Riemann. This is how we define the curvature tensor. This thing, I think, usually goes under the name of the Ricci identity. So remember, we expanded this thing out. Actually, we didn't. I told you that you should. It's a good thing to check. But if you expand this thing out, you in other words, you convert all of these covariant derivatives into partial derivatives plus connections. All of the terms in the expansion in which a partial derivative acts on V drop out, and you're left only with terms that are proportional to V with no derivatives acting on it. So you collect all the terms, and the thing that V ultimately ends up being proportional to is what you define as R, and in that way we found a formula for R in terms of the curvature, in terms of the Christoffel symbols, that was this. Anyway. Okay. There was a gamma with a partial derivative, a gamma with a partial derivative, and then there was plus a product of two gammas, and then there was a product of two gammas. So now we're going to do the exact same thing. We'll say delta sub gamma, delta sub delta, minus, capital D, this is the gauge covariant derivative, capital D sub gamma, capital D sub delta, minus capital D sub delta, capital D sub gamma, acting on a column vector of n scalar fields, is, by definition, I, G, F, gamma delta. So you're familiar with the fact that the field strength in Yang-Mills theory, the field strength in electromagnetism only has two Lorentz indices, and it's anti-symmetric under those. So F mu nu, the electromagnetic field strength, but in Yang-Mills theory, this F is going to, in addition to having two Lorentz indices, it's going to be a matrix on the gauge space. It's going to have two gauge indices. And that's, you can see from here that's what it has to do to end up looking like this. So if we show those indices explicitly, it'll be like FAB gamma delta phi sub B. That's how we define the field strength. And so you can see that this, again, this thing is clearly playing exactly the same role as the Riemann curvature tensor did with respect to the, so this thing is the curvature on the gauge bundle, like we were saying before. This thing is the curvature on the tangent bundle. There's two different linear spaces over each point in the manifold. There's a vector space with n component n component scalar fields, and then there's a vector space with, let's say, four component actual vectors that point in some direction in space-time. The collection of all of that one sort of vector space is the tangent bundle, and the collection of all that other sort of vector space over the manifold is the gauge bundle, and this is the curvature on the gauge bundle, just the way that this was the Riemann curvature on the tangent bundle. And so just as we expanded this out, found that all the partial derivatives, all the terms in which a partial derivative acts on V, dropped out, and we were left with this expression for the remaining proportionality constant. You do the exact same thing here. You expand out all of these covariant derivatives as partial derivatives plus connections. You find exactly the same thing, that all of the terms in which a partial derivative acts on phi automatically cancel. And the remaining terms, you separate out the proportionality constant, define that as F, and you get this expression for what F gamma delta is. So here I'm going to keep the Lorentz indices gamma delta and just use matrix notation for the other two gauge indices. So just to not screw it up, you get the usual expression from E and M. And then plus just the plus IG times the commutator of A gamma and A delta. Remember, what I mean by commutator here is, in addition to its Lorentz index, this thing is a matrix with two gauge indices. So that gauge that n by n matrix times that n by n matrix minus the commuted product. That's what I mean. That's what that commutator means. Okay. So again, the result is another n by n matrix on the n dimensional that space of scalar fields, even though it now has two And in addition, it has two Lorentz indices, which are antisymmetric. Okay, so now have I lost everybody? Who? Well, yeah.
I have a quick question. So, what is the curvature on the gauge polynomial?
So, one way to say it is that it means this. But again, in other words, it means it's just the local way to say it is that it measures the failure of two covariant derivatives to commute with one another. But an answer you will like better, I imagine. A more pictorial answer is that because the covariant derivatives fail to commute, you will find that if you pick a vector just as in a space with no curvature, in a flat space like the blackboard, I can take a vector here. So in other words, a vector in spacetime, let's say what I usually call something like V alpha, and I can now parallel transport it along any curve I want. And okay, so it'll go like this, and it'll end up being some vector, and then I can take any other curve that I want, and I will parallel transport and I'll get the same vector, whichever path I take it along. But then when there's curvature, if you work out the parallel transport equations, so we had this equation for parallel transport that allowed you to, given the vector here, figure out an infinitesimal d tau away, what are the new components of the vector, and so forth, and you integrate it up. And then you do the same thing over here. You will find that you get a different answer. And if you now shrink these, if you now move these points very close to one another, infinitesimally far from one another, and now your two different paths just look like a path that first goes in the gamma direction and then goes in the delta direction, and another path that first goes in the delta direction and then goes in the gamma direction, you will again find that because these infinitesimal paths are different, there will be an infinitesimal difference in the resulting tangent vector, and that in this infinitesimal limit, that infinitesimal difference will be proportional to the failure of these two covariant derivatives, of the failure of these covariant derivatives to commute. But then what I wanted to say is that it's now the exact same thing, the exact same story is true, if now you have a column vector of scalar fields at one point on the manifold, and you ask, if I parallel transport that column vector to get a new one over here, and then I do it along a different path, I will get a different answer if f mu nu is not zero when f mu nu is not zero. Needless to say, that was a very sort of mathematical response in the context of sort of how I'm laying things out. This is an actual physical force field. So this thing being zero versus not zero for the electromagnetic field is the difference between a charge feeling a force and not feeling a force when it's at that point in space-time. And this thing being zero versus not zero for the SU3 gauge field, for the gluon gauge fields, there's an SU3 gauge field in the standard model, is the difference between quarks being acted on by a force versus not being acted on by a force. Okay. Okay, I should wrap this up almost immediately. The thing that I just erased, the transformation law for the A's under a gauge transformation, if you plug that into this formula, you will find that F transforms like it should under a gauge transformation. It transforms like F twiddle gamma delta is equal to F So now F is a matrix. A vector should transform like this. But F has two gauge indices, one up and one down. And so it should transform like this. And that is what you will find. Another way you can see that is over here. You know how the D's transform. They've already been arranged to transform nicely. So if you replace each D by D twiddle is equal to U D U inverse over here, a U always hits a U inverse in between these two. And so the whole thing transforms. The overall effect is to put a U over here and a U inverse over here. And so you can also automatically see that way that this thing will transform like a tensor, not with some weird transformation law. And so since it's a tensor, since it transforms nicely under gauge transformations, I can now form the all-important kinetic energy. I can now write down my first term in the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, the most important term in the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, which is just F gamma delta. And that's a matrix where I've suppressed the two indices. I'll just write the two indices. No, I won't write the two indices. That's a matrix. Not with respect to these guys. For every fixed value of gamma and for every fixed value of delta, this is an n by n matrix. Then I can contract that. I can multiply it by another one, and contract them. And so now this is both a Lorentz scalar. So that's good. We want special relativity to be true. But now, so this is a product of two matrices. So at the moment, it's not so good because it still has product of two matrices is another matrix. It has one upper index and one lower indices. So we've managed to get rid of all of the Lorentz indices. So it's a Lorentz scalar, but it's not yet a scalar under gauge transformations because it still has these indices hanging off. Since it transforms simply, we know that it transforms like under a gauge transformation times U inverse. That means that we can make it into a scalar under gauge transformations also by just taking the trace over the gauge indices. So in other words, we multiply. I had previously written gauge indices around this thing with an So I multiply the whole thing by if this product has an upper index gauge index A and a lower gauge index B, I multiply it by the identity matrix with upper index B and upper index A. I just contract it with the identity matrix to remove any hanging indices. That's the same as just saying I take the product of two matrices. That's a new matrix. Now I take the trace of that matrix. And that means I take the trace of this matrix. But then you know that when you take a trace of some product of factors, you can always take the factor from the end and move it around to the front. You're free to do that when you're inside a trace. And so this becomes U. This is illegible, I know. But so that says U inverse times U times F, but U inverse times U cancels. So the trace of FF is a scalar under both of the symmetries that you want, Lorentz symmetry and gauge symmetry. And so there you go. That is essentially your kinetic term. And so basically, we built the connection. We then used the connection to define a curvature, and then once we had a curvature, we had some tensor that represented something about the structure of the gauge field. And now to build our action in general relativity, we just found the simplest way to contract all the indices on the curvature tensor to get a scalar, and in that case we took G alpha beta R alpha beta, and our action was just a constant times that, In this case, we did the same thing. We just looked for the simplest way to take our nice curvature tensors and contract up all the indices so that there were no hanging indices left over. And that is that times, well, times minus 1/4. That's proportional then to the, yeah, to the Ing-Mills action.
If you took just F and took the trace of it, that would be
zero.
That's a good point. Yes, that's a very good point. So the reason that you cannot that you can't just use a single F, like we use the single R here, and contract the indices, is because unlike this R, which is symmetric, so that you get a non-zero answer when you contract it with a symmetric tensor. F is anti-symmetric, and you get zero if you contract it if you just tried contracting this with eta gamma delta. Okay. Okay, so I ended up liking that so much that I spent more time on it than I should have. But my liking of it is definitely, at least in part, a reflection of the fact that it's like a really good thing to know. So I apologize. I went on longer than I should have with that. But I'm saying I could do worse by you. Okay, so then I have to make my joke quick before I go on. So the detective Ivanov, he opens the door and the light turns on, and he closes the door and the light turns off. So he opens the door again and the light turns on, and then he closes it and the light turns off. It's terrible to laugh at your own jokes further over. And so he says, the pieces are beginning to fit together. It must be some kind of refrigerator. Anyway. So the next thing I wanted to tell you about were the key spacetimes. So first we have our maximally symmetric spacetimes. And so these are your old friend, just flat Euclidean space, the space even the Greeks knew about. The sphere, Greeks knew about that one. The hyperboloid, I don't actually know. I don't actually know much history. So. Minkowski space, De Sitter space, and anti-De Sitter space. And then the Friedman, Robertson, Walker metrics. In other words, the cosmological metrics. And so what I'm going to explain is that these three guys all have purely positive signature. All of their directions are space-like. In the metric, there's no minus signs that appear. There's no time-like directions. These are the exact analogous spaces, but where there's one time-like direction in the metric. So the metric now has signature, whereas this metric in four dimensions had signature 4, 0, 4, 0, 4, 0. This guy has signature 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1. FRW spacetimes are nothing but the spacetimes where you take, where they're maximally symmetric in the spatial direction, but then there's no particular symmetry in the time direction. In the spatial direction, you take one of these purely spatial metrics, in the three-dimensional version of it, and you can choose either of those three, and that corresponds to a flat, closed, or open universe. But then you just let it stretch in any way that it wants as time goes by. So those metrics are going to look like, this is the arbitrary stretching factor as a function of time. I've added one time-like direction, and then I'm just going to multiply times whatever the line element was for these metrics. So the three-dimensional line element corresponding to one of these three metrics. And then three is the black hole metrics, where the name of a spinning black hole is sorry, the name of a non-spinning black hole, just a black hole that's just sitting there being spherically symmetric, is the Schwarzschild geometry. And the name of the spinning black hole, which is not spherically symmetric, it only has axial symmetry about the spin direction and translation time, is the Kerr metric. Okay. So, here, all I want to explain is that these are all just the same spaces with a minus sign flipped here or there. So it's very easy to understand them all in a single way, and they're all very simple spaces. So it, provided you choose the right coordinates, you can calculate everything about them very simply. So let's start as a warm up for the general construction. Think of the sphere. So the sphere is the way you usually imagine that is you imagine. So the two-dimensional sphere, the way you usually imagine that is you imagine some surface like this, x squared plus y squared plus z squared is equal to a constant, rho squared, where rho is the radius of the sphere. And that's a two-dimensional surface embedded in a three-dimensional Euclidean space, which has metric dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And more generally, the n-dimensional sphere is I take coordinates. Okay, let me use capital letters. So to get the two-dimensional sphere, we worked in this three-dimensional space. We got the two-dimensional sphere, you know, the ordinary sphere of a basketball, the surface of a basketball, or whatever, as a surface embedded in a space of one higher dimension, three dimensions. So we're going to do the same thing. We're going to get the n-dimensional sphere and the n-dimensional whatever by embedding it in a simple surface in a space of n plus one dimensions. And so let me use capital letters to denote indices that run from 1 to n plus 1, so in the sort of ambient bigger space, and lowercase letters to denote indices that just run up to n, so the actual dimension of the space or space-time that we're ultimately aiming to construct. So the n-dimensional sphere is this thing, embedded in a space with this metric. And so now if we want to write the metric, the metric in the ambient n plus one dimensional space induces a metric on the n dimensional surface just by the fact that if I take two nearby points on the surface, the distance between those two points as defined by the metric in the ambient space should be the same as the distance between those two points as defined by the metric on the surface. Is this clear? It's hard to get an answer to the question if it's clear. In other words, in my three-dimensional space, if I have two points with coordinates x, y, z, and x plus dx, y plus dy, z plus dz, one way to calculate that is to say that its distance is the distance in the ambient space, which we said was this. But another thing to say is that its distance is there's some metric on the sphere, just a two-dimensional metric, g lowercase a lowercase b times d x lowercase a d x lowercase b, where these are these are two-dimensional coordinates on the sphere itself. And equating these two things defines what this two-dimensional metric on the sphere is. So in particular, if we just want to see it explicitly, we just eliminate the n plus one coordinate, the unnecessary extra coordinate. So we solve this equation for x n plus one. So in particular, explicitly, it's plus or minus the square root of rho squared minus d ab xa xb, where these are the same. These x's are the same as these x's, but now the index is only running from 1 to n because it's a lowercase index, right? And then I just take the differential of that. to calculate. So that allows me to write dxn plus 1 in terms of d of the other n coordinates that I ultimately want. And I use that expression to eliminate dxn plus 1 wherever it appears here. So I end up with a purely n-dimensional expression. Yeah?
So in that expression where you have xn plus 1 equal to square root of the stuff.
Right.
The x's within the square root
are the same.
Are the same x's that appear in the defining equation, but now
yes.
In the range, smaller range.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
these
right.
These are new coordinates.
These are the same. These are the same coordinates, but I've just in my notation is a little bit too slick here. I've used capital AB over here to denote the x's, the x coordinate system, but running from x1 up to xn plus 1. And then this is the same coordinates, but I've switched to lowercase a and lowercase b. So now it's just the same coordinates, but I'm only letting this sum run over the first n coordinates and omitting the n plus 1. Yeah. Okay, so when I just go through that, I find the metric. Explicitly, it's not so bad, really. Okay. And voila! I now have the metric on the n-sphere obtained very simply. This is the metric written in so-called quasi-Cartesian coordinates. Okay, which for obvious reasons, because I had these basically Cartesian coordinates over here, and I just kept the first n of them, and those are my n coordinates on the n-sphere. And again, as Tibor said, this expression you see has only lowercase indices, so. It only involves in any way the first n coordinates. So it's explicitly an n-dimensional metric.
How did you get this expression from which formula?
The DS.
I took the expression for the surface of interest, solved it for xn plus 1, took the differential of both sides, and used it to eliminate the dxn plus 1, dxn plus 1 term over here. So the first 1 through n terms are just reappear down here in this first term. And the term that used to be dxn plus 1, dxn plus 1, is this second term. Okay? Can I 2 minutes? Just so the point is, now let's say I want to produce. So now let me say that a to a b is kind of a standard notation for the Minkowski metric, and I will say a to a b p comma q is the flat metric of signature p comma q. So in other words, dxa dxb, so there's p plus signs and then q minus signs. So this expanded out, this looks like dx1 squared plus dxp squared minus dxp plus 1 squared minus dxp plus q squared. Okay, so now, my board organization skills are terrible. That's another, even once I get the eraser thing under control, it's still going to be a gaping hole in my. So now I'm just going to repeat this procedure, these three steps exactly, but the only difference is I'm going to replace delta AB by the metric, which I'll call A to AB, which is just A to AB P comma Q plus one additional coordinate. So DX, because again, this is, let's say this is an n-dimensional metric. I eventually want to embed things in an n plus 1 dimensional space. So my n plus 1 dimensional space will have the following metric. Dx capital A, dx capital B. So that's the n plus 1 dimensional metric is equal to the n dimensional metric with signature P, comma Q. What am I doing? And then plus one additional coordinate, one additional orthogonal coordinate, k dx n plus 1 squared, where k will be plus 1 if at the end of the day I want to get... So the idea is at the end of the day I want to get the space of constant curvature and signature p, comma q in n dimensions. And if I want to get the space of constant positive curvature, I'll put k as plus 1 here. If I want to get the space of constant negative curvature, I'll put k equals minus 1 here. And if I want to get the space of zero curvature, I will put k equals 0 there and just be done. I mean, I'll be already done, right? That is the space of that signature and constant zero curvature. And so that's the metric on the embedding space. And again, I want to embed in that space a surface, and the surface that I embed is again just the natural sort of quasi-sphere in that space. It looks just like we wrote down the embedding surface as delta AB XA XB. I'm going to take the metric on the embedding space and use it to define a sphere. And now that is equal to K rho squared. So if I'm looking for a space of positive curvature like the sphere, the thing on the right-hand side will just be rho squared like it was in this equation. But if I want to get a space of negative curvature, I put minus rho squared. Okay, so there's these two additional k's and some extra minus signs in this metric. But other than that, we've done exactly the same thing. And now, again, you just solve this for the n plus 1th coordinate, take the differential, use it to eliminate that term up here, and you get your metric. And the metric again looks almost exactly analogous to that. It's this thing that I called eta, the flat metric with signature p, comma q, plus So in other words, it's exactly that thing with an extra k in the denominator and with all of the deltas replaced by this eta p comma q. So there you go. That's and so now the only thing left to say, essentially, is that, no, that's not true, but almost the only thing left to say is that, so now we have a little table and those six spaces are just, so let's say that this is signature k equals plus 1, k equals... So now the following table is the key thing. Okay, this is the two different signatures of interest and the different possible curvatures of interest. So if you have purely positive, purely space-like signature and positive curvature, that's the n-sphere. If it's space-time, you have one time-like direction and positive curvature, that's De Sitter space, n-dimensional De Sitter space. If you have negative curvature, that's called the n-hyperboloid. Or if it's a space-time, if it has one time-like direction, that's anti-De Sitter. And then if you have k equals 0, that's just n-dimensional Euclidean space or n-dimensional Minkowski space. So that's all. So a problem on the first problem set. I go through the notes, but I go through it in the notes. So the point is that it's very easy to derive a very easy and very useful fact that's true for any of these spaces is that the Riemann curvature tensor, that should really be ABCD, but because I'm already late, is, there could be an n minus 1 up here. I'm actually, I forget now, but there's a simple expression that is, yes.
What do you say the positive curvature in the Schiller space is at n minus e?
Oh, sorry, that's n dimensional. Just so, yeah. Okay, so basically, I'll continue next time. So next time, honest to God, we will get started with the Friedman metric. We're somewhere between like half and three quarters of a lecture behind, but we're gonna, I don't know, we're gonna, you know, it's like budgets need to be cut and something, you know, it's gonna hurt whatever gets cut, but it's gonna hurt me more than it hurts you. Okay.